From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Kelly McEvers. This episode, how to talk to parents who choose not to vaccinate their kids. Doctors say it's a threat to public health, but some parents don't agree.
If you haven't seen polio or measles, then you don't think that your child is really at risk of getting it.
They're gambling with my kids' lives when they don't vaccinate their kids.
The big business of illegal animal trafficking.
If it walks, crawls, swims, flies, somebody eats it, collects it, wears it, or wants to.
And Haiti, like you've never heard it before. Ha! That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. So we're on the road here. I recently spent a few days in Marin County, just north of San Francisco, consistently ranked one of the richest counties in the U.S.
The architecture is all very subtle, all kinds of browns and mauves. This is a beautiful mountain area. There are signs all over the town that talk about composting and recycling and how to help your community.
Not far from here is a private preschool with wooden toys and discovery gardens. I talked to people from the school, but I didn't go there. The story officials had to tell was so controversial, they said, they didn't want to talk about it on tape. Last year, two children whose parents had chosen not to vaccinate them got whooping cough. Eventually, school officials sent the kids home. Whooping cough, a disease we thought we were rid of decades ago when a vaccination for it became mandatory for children. In 2010, 10 babies died of whooping cough in Marin County. More than 9,000 people caught the disease. In some school districts in Marin County, around half of the parents choose not to vaccinate. Public health records show the number of parents opting out of vaccines has quadrupled since the late 90s.
We will sing and bless this place.
This is a video that locals showed me from a playground dedication ceremony at the preschool with the whooping cough cases. We're not saying the name of the school because of the controversy. After the cases, some parents and school officials checked to see if the school could close its doors to children who haven't been vaccinated. What they found was a state legal system that's unclear on the subject. They didn't want to get sued, so they did nothing. Now, the non-vaccinated kids are back at school, and officials are worried about offending the parents who don't vaccinate. With new measles outbreaks here in Southern California and in New York and British Columbia, it's our cover story today. Can we talk about vaccines? Matt Willis is a public health officer for Marin County.
Welcome. Hi.
A few days ago, he sat down at a table with a PowerPoint presentation for a handful of local pediatricians.
So why are we doing this? Well, Marin County has some of the highest personal belief exemption rates in the state of California. You know, that's basically people opting out of some or all of required school vaccines.
Personal belief exemptions, basically a form you fill out so you don't have to vaccinate your kids. 48 states in the U.S. allow for some kind of exemption, except West Virginia and Mississippi. California now requires a doctor's signature on the form. But in Marin, parents are still able to find doctors who will sign the form. So Willis decided to do a survey. He and his colleagues asked moms and dads why they don't vaccinate their kids.
So these are some of the themes that came out of the survey. The preference for natural immunity over immunity conferred by vaccines. Children's perceived as low risk for some vaccine-preventable diseases. And lack of trust of the healthcare system and pharmaceutical industry.
Willis thinks if pediatricians know why parents aren't vaccinating, then doctors can come up with responses to try to change their minds.
One reason parents cited for requesting personal belief exemptions is that vaccines may contain unsafe toxins. Has that come up for you all? Yeah? How do you address that?
Some doctors say they try the soft approach. Michael Yamaguchi says he gives parents articles from scientific journals.
I hand the article and I go, look, if you're going to kind of disbelieve this, you have to be saying these eight authors, the entire editorial board, are all in somehow collusion to create some sort of data that's untrue.
Other doctors like Peter Simon and Lisa Levitt say in some cases, showing parents the evidence is the last thing you want to do.
But it's hard to really come in thinking I'm gonna change their position completely.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there are those parents who come in with their mind made up and there is nothing that you can say that will sway them.
It's a theory that was recently borne out by a study at Dartmouth. Political scientists surveyed nearly 1,800 parents about the vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. Turns out the more skeptical parents are about vaccines, the less likely they are to listen to public service ads or to their pediatricians. So if traditional approaches don't work, how do you convince people to vaccinate? One pediatrician in Marin County, Nelson Branco, decided to do more than just talk.
In 2012, we were very concerned about measles.
The London Olympics were coming up.
And the European Cup in Eastern Europe.
Lots of people would be traveling, picking up germs.
So we decided that we were going to choose one vaccine, the MMR vaccine, and that would be our line in the sand.
In other words, Branco gave his patients an ultimatum. Vaccinate your toddler against measles, mumps, and rubella by the time the kid is two, or find a new pediatrician. And for some people, it worked.
There were many families that were on the fence about vaccines who chose to get the MMR vaccine and stayed in our practice. There were very few families that left our practice.
Fewer than 20 families left. About 150 families chose to vaccinate. Branco says what people don't understand is if you don't vaccinate your child could die from some of these diseases. But if you and your children are already vaccinated, why should you care? Well, first of all, trying to stop an outbreak is expensive. A 2008 measles outbreak in San Diego cost an estimated $10,000 per patient to contain, according to local public health officials. Seth Mnookin wrote a book on this stuff called The Panic Virus. We got in touch with him for an interview. He says he asked one California epidemiologist which communities are most affected by these expensive outbreaks.
And he said, sure, we just take out a map and put a push pin everywhere there's a Whole Foods and draw a circle around that area. He was speaking slightly in jest, but what he was referring to is the fact that you do see a number of well-educated, politically liberal people who self-identify as being environmentally conscious, like Marin County in California, like Boulder, Colorado. But you also see some people with a very libertarian bent coming at this from a different angle.
Mnookin says one reason these communities aren't vaccinating is because of a sense of exceptionalism, a sense that it can't happen here. But it can happen. We should all care about non-vaccinators, Mnookin says. And here's why. It's all about herd immunity. Put simply, the idea that enough people in the community have to be vaccinated to protect those for whom vaccines might not work. In many communities like Marin County, we no longer have herd immunity to stuff like measles. That's why we're seeing the recent outbreaks. For some families, this is dangerous. Like Sonia and Holden Green, who live outside Chicago. They went to a studio to tell us their story. Hi, Holden.
Hi.
Is this the first time you've ever been in a radio studio?
Yeah.
How does it feel?
It's fun.
Holden is in fifth grade. He goes to school, plays soccer. But Holden and two of his brothers have an immune disorder called XLA. Sonia recently blogged about it.
Basically, Holden and two of his brothers are walking around with half their immune system missing. And so Holden was exposed to something last spring, which for another kid might not have been so bad, but for Holden it actually caused a Pseudomonas infection in his skin, which required him to be in the hospital. And those are the things that we worry about.
How long were you in the hospital, Holden?
For about a week.
Yeah? How'd it feel?
It was a little bit scary. And also, they had to put like 3 IVs in every day, so they had just one place that they put it in. But they would put one in at like 11 in the morning, about like 3, and then one at like 1 a.m.
Yeah. Sonia, can your boys, can they be vaccinated?
They can't. Or rather, they can. Best case scenario, it would do no good. But the worst case scenario is that they simply wouldn't mount the immune response that you have to the vaccine, and that it would actually make them sick.
So then you have to rely on other parents to vaccinate their kids.
Yes.
Do you talk to parents about this?
I do, a lot, to anybody who'll listen. Yes. Yes.
Where? How?
So if people are having a conversation about medical issues, or yeah, sometimes even if they're not, I'll just mention, hey, my kids have this, and when people say, you know, oh, but your boys look so healthy, you'd never know if there was anything wrong with them. I tell them very honestly that part of what keeps them healthy is the medicine they take. But a big part of it is the fact that we live in a community where most people are vaccinated.
So has that happened? You personally have convinced people to vaccinate their kids after telling them your story?
Yes, there have been a couple of families, and it wasn't an instant reaction. It wasn't, okay, well, now I'm convinced. With one family that I talked to in person, I got an email from them a little bit later saying, you know, we were on the fence, we thought about what you said, and we've decided to vaccinate, which was fantastic. Another family emailed me after reading my blog post, and they're a family that we know, and they said, you know, I didn't know this about your family, but I was hesitant to vaccinate, and now that I know why it's important to people in my community, I'm going to choose to vaccinate. So that was, it was great.
Anybody you talked to who hardened their position even further?
No one has told me that to my face, but certainly in Facebook exchanges, email exchanges, responses to blog posts, I've gotten into some discussions with people who do become more entrenched. When I try to make it personal about my kids, I can see how they flip it and they say, well, to me, it's personal about my kids. But I think part of it is they just become more entrenched in their position because they kind of feel like they're coming under attack. And I understand that.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like this is going to have to get to a point where it's like, you know, people drawing the line in the sand saying like, look, this preschool, this play date, this playground, this classroom, you know, everybody here is vaccinated.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I don't know if it needs to come through legislation or if it just needs to come through more public pressure. Certainly as a parent, I can say that, you know, I'm ready to pull my kids from a situation where if I know that most people around them aren't vaccinated, they're not going to that party. Or if it were a school, they're not attending that school. To me, it's they're gambling with my kids' lives when they don't vaccinate their kids.
Well, Sonia Green and Holden Green, thank you guys so much.
Of course.
Thanks, Holden.
You're welcome.
Take care.
You too.
This is NPR News. Trafficking in exotic animals is big business. And it turns out Southern California is a hub. A man recently was caught trying to smuggle frozen sea cucumbers from Mexico. These are actually animals. They look like giant slugs. He had stuffed 100 pounds of these things into the spare tire compartment of his car. 100 pounds worth up to $10,000. NPR's Danny Hajek reports on the very lucrative animal smuggling industry.
When it comes to exotic animals, there is a huge demand. Inside Reptile Finders, a pet shop along the Pacific Coast Highway just outside L.A., you'll find terrariums filled with
chameleons, tarantulas, frogs, pythons, boas.
27-year-old Chuck Dundov manages this place, and when it comes to exotic animals, he plays by the rules.
I have to. I mean, this is my business. We always keep it 100% legit here.
But he does hear talk of people looking to buy smuggled animals.
All the time. You can't own a cobra, you can't own a Komodo dragon. It's completely illegal.
And that, he says, is the allure.
If it's illegal, you want it even more. But at least I'm not the one that's providing it or having any part in the illegal reptile trade.
Southern California provides a lot of avenues to get wildlife in and out of the country.
Erin Dean with the Fish and Wildlife Service tracks illegal animal trade. She points to LAX, the sixth busiest airport in the world, the Port of LA, the busiest port in the nation, and then there's the Mexico border.
Currently, we have 207 special agents and 126 wildlife inspectors around the country. So we are a very small law enforcement agency with a big job.
A job that requires help from U.S. Customs and Border Protection at the ports of entry.
Thank you.
Michael Ferguson is on the front lines. He's in charge of inspecting plants, food, and animals that come through LAX, and he's seen just about everything. Like in 2009, when they detained a passenger flying in from Vietnam.
The officer that was interviewing him looked at him. Everything looked fine, just to look at him. But then, when they sat there and looked at his shoes, there were bird droppings on the top of his shoes.
When they pulled up the legs of his pants, they discovered 14 songbirds.
He took the entire flight with these birds taped to his legs.
if it walks, crawls, swims, flies. Somebody eats it, collects it, wears it, or wants to.
Joseph Johns is a federal prosecutor of environmental crimes. He says the black market for exotic animals is a multi-billion dollar industry.
We're talking narcotics smuggling and the black market for weapons. And right behind that is the market for illegal wildlife here in the U.S. and globally.
He pages through a stack of case files on his desk.
You know, one of the more interesting cases that we've had in the office recently involves a TV personality by the name of Donald Schultz.
The former host of Wild Recon on Animal Planet. When he was a guest on the cable talk show Chelsea Lately 3 years ago, Schultz handed host Chelsea Handler a small fennec fox native to North Africa.
Can you have him as a pet?
Absolutely not, no.
Why?
Because there's certain laws that prohibit the keeping of certain animals. Like these guys actually make.
But Schultz himself was found guilty of selling two endangered desert monitor lizards to an undercover agent for $2,600. Ian Riccio, curator at the LA Zoo, identified them. When these sorts of animals turn up, Riccio is the guy they call.
You don't know what's maybe broken loose. You never know what you're going to get.
He says a couple years ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service intercepted a stuffed animal with something inside. Paper bindles filled with scorpions.
Very neatly, with their legs kind of compressed and their tail compressed.
He carefully unpacked them with a scorpion expert from the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles.
And he said, wow, you know. I said, well, what is that? And he said, well, we rate scorpion toxicity as far as their sting and their danger from a scale of 1 to 4. And I said, well, what was that one? He said, well, that was a 5. So I said, wow. He goes, yeah, that was one of the most deadly scorpions in the world, he told me.
That package was shipped from Egypt through regular mail. Each instance of smuggling is as bizarre and unique as the next. Back at LAX, Michael Ferguson says over the past few years, he's seen fewer live animals and more animal parts coming through the x-ray.
Elephant skin, elephant toenails. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, some of the stuff, but it's all those different parts. That one gentleman that came in that had this giant tusk inside of his box of furniture.
He says it all comes down to keeping up with the latest smuggling trends. Like 2 years ago in Delhi's airport in India, when three smugglers hid tiny loris monkeys in their underwear. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
Here in California, it's not uncommon to hear ads like this.
There's gold in them hills. Royal Gold organic potting soil, that is.
Canna nutrients are media specific, so it doesn't matter if you're hydro or soil, cocoa or clay.
Come on down out of them hills, down to the harvest safe.
These could be ads for products to help your flowers or something else. Medical marijuana, now legal in several states. But it's an illegal substance, according to the federal government, which poses an interesting question. How do you advertise a product like that? Harry Cole specializes in broadcast law. He joined me to talk about what you can and can't advertise when it comes to legal weed.
There are no rules against advertising it at this point. There are some restrictions on how to advertise. You're not supposed to market to kids, for example. Other than that, as of right now, the FCC has taken no position at all on the propriety or the legality of advertising marijuana. Many broadcasters are concerned, I believe, that the FCC could conclude that the promotion of the killer weed would be just a bad thing. And then taking that out to the logical extension, we will take away your license if you do that.
I want to play you a clip of an ad that aired here in California, up in Humboldt County, actually. The clip isn't advertising marijuana, but it seems pretty clear that when it's talking about gardening supplies, what they're supposed to be used for. Let's play it.
It's a mean green trimming machine from Trim Scene for, trimming flowers.
Don't see nothing but green in this jukebox.
Oh, Granny, you know we're part of that specialty flower co-op. Crop's too big to arrange them all ourselves, even with our friends coming by to help.
All those secret meetings in there.
Okay, so is this kosher? Is this okay?
Sure. Sure. I mean, if you could advertise the straight-out dope, you can certainly advertise the secondary paraphernalia. And again, there are no rules preventing you from doing that. But you know, the kind of tiptoeing around the issue, that it's vaguely reminiscent of what happened back in the 60s and 70s with drug lyrics. The commission announced early on that they really didn't think it was a good idea for broadcast stations to be playing records that celebrate or promote drug use. There was no rule against it. The commission wasn't doing anything, but it was arching its eyebrow and shaking its finger at you and saying, you know, you better watch out because we could do something if we wanted to, so you better watch your step.
So is that something you could see happening now, you know, saying, look, we're not going to take away your license, but watch yourself?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. But again, the commission hasn't done that. And I think that's because the federal government as a whole has demonstrated a fairly clear ambivalence to what's going on. But there was at least that threat. You know, you start seeing these things in the newspapers, you start worrying.
We know there's one time a day when some of the rules don't apply and when stations are more willing to do things, and that's late night. Do you think we're going to see, you know, more marijuana ads mixed in with those late night ads in the future?
It wouldn't surprise me, because that's when the munchies strike. Come on.
So they say.
I've read about that in books, but yeah, I would think that if you're going to see it start, you're going to see it start at that time of day, because for sure the one thing that advertisers don't want to do is appear to be appealing to young kids.
Harry Cole is a lawyer who specializes in broadcast law. He joined me to talk about the legal issues surrounding marijuana advertisements. Harry, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Rocky Mountain High.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers. Yesterday, I did what a lot of people here in Southern California do every day. I got in my car and hit the freeway. So here we are. We are about to cross the county line from Los Angeles County into San Bernardino County. The reason we're doing this drive is it's a well-worn path. More people moved from LA County to San Bernardino County over the last decade than any other county-to-county pair in the whole country. Tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands. It's something that's happening all over the country. In the places with the most economic opportunity, housing prices are too high. So now, instead of moving toward the good jobs, sometimes people have to move away from them. It's our cover story today. Americans on the move in the wrong direction. When we finally get to San Bernardino, we drive to a complex of two-story apartment buildings. Built in the 60s or 70s, peeling yellow paint, surrounded by a 10-foot-high security gate with spikes on top. Jamika takes us up to her balcony.
So cool. So how long have you been in this place?
I've been here going on a year now.
Jamika is 28. She says she doesn't want to use her full name, doesn't want too many people to know about her situation. She says she grew up in a rented house in South Central L.A. The house was foreclosed on, and she and her siblings had to move out. Money was tight, so Jamika moved here, to the Inland Empire. People call it the IE.
So my older sister was already out here. Then me and my other sister came out here. My brother slowly came out here. And then my other brother came out here, but he went straight to a house because that's what he could afford. He could do all that stuff. And then my other sister, she's the only one who stays out in Los Angeles still, in her home that she has. So
out of how many siblings, one stays?
It's five that's out in IE, and one is still out there.
Jamika says she probably won't go back to L.A.
Yeah, I missed it when I was younger, but right now I'm on my grown woman status, job, car, house, well, apartment, so I'm good.
Jamika works in food service at a nearby hospital. She doesn't want to say how much she pays in rent. She does say it's public housing. Neighbors make about $700 a month and pay $100 to $200 in rent. Jamika says here she actually can save some money. No way she could do that in L.A.
Yeah, I have another friend in here who lives in Los Angeles who moved out here. I don't know if you want to talk to her.
Sure. Tamia.
Inside Jamika's apartment, her friend Tamia says she also moved to San Bernardino from L.A. Oh, okay. So do two other ladies we meet outside. Census data suggests tens of thousands of people have made this move. IRS returns say it could be hundreds of thousands. To know how cheap San Bernardino is, look on Craigslist. Two-bedroom apartments here are as cheap as $700 a month. And to buy a house, the median home price in San Bernardino is just $173,000. In L.A., it's nearly three times that. So it makes sense that people would move here to save money on housing. But what does the city have to offer?
You know, San Bernardino's bankrupt. The city's bankrupt.
Standing out in front of City Hall, City Councilman Jim Mulvihill tells me San Bernardino's not in the best shape right now.
Because of that, we've cut back. We had 340 on our police force. Now we're down about 240. And given all that, we got a high crime rate, had a lot of shootings, so people are concerned.
Jim used to be a professor of urban planning at Cal State San Bernardino. He says there are two kinds of people who move here from L.A. County. The first because...
they've got a job. They work in L.A. or they work in Los Angeles. But the point is they want to buy a house and, you know, they're not quite up to the income level. And so, as you know, the realtor is always talking about you drive until you qualify.
1 to 2 hours each way. And that's if you have a job when you leave L.A. County. For people who come here without a job, Jim says the options are not good.
And you're going to make a, up at the light, you're going to make a right.
Driving around town, Jim says, like so many American cities, San Bernardino used to be a place for middle-class jobs. A big steel plant employed tens of thousands of people until it closed in the 80s. And then?
Norton Air Force Base closed up in the early 1990s. And at Norton, there was about 10,000 civilian jobs and about 6,000 military people. And so the city lost all those.
Jim Mulvihill says the jobs that are available are low-wage jobs. The local casino, food service jobs like the one Jamaica has, and one of San Bernardino's biggest industries.
A lot of warehouses.
For retailers like Amazon. So even though people are saving money on housing here, they're making less money than they might in L.A., where there are more and better-paying jobs. It's a phenomenon we're seeing across the U.S., says writer Timothy Noah. And not just in the expensive places we all know, like San Francisco, New York, and Boston.
Maryland is not a place where you'll find many millionaires or billionaires, but it is a place where you find an awful lot of highly paid lawyers. So it has the highest median income in the country. And yet, for most of the last 20 years, more people have moved out of Maryland than into it.
Because, you know, you would think that these boom towns, San Francisco, Boston, I mean, the idea is that if you build a tech company, there's got to be somebody to build the building, to clean the building, I mean, that it creates jobs. Is it that the jobs are there, but people can't afford to stay and do the jobs?
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. The local business press in San Francisco quoted a guy named David Hayes, who's the CEO of Skyline Construction. And he said his biggest challenge was recruiting. And he said, we started relocating candidates from Southern California and recruiting out-of-state candidates. He said that they've even started asking retired workers to re-enter the workforce. It's a vicious circle. People can't afford to move to these places. And then you can't find or you struggle to find people to build what housing does get constructed.
I want to go back to our example, the example of moving from L.A. to San Bernardino. What could be done to fix that problem? I mean, you're saying that it's a housing issue, right?
It's one of two ways. You have to tackle the housing problem, but you also have to tackle the inequality problem. There are a lot of people who think they don't need to worry about income inequality. But to the extent that it is choking the avenue towards economic growth and towards economic opportunity, they do need to worry about it. And this seems to me a good example where it is blocking a pathway to opportunity. All economies rely on migration as a way to grow. People need to be able to pick up and go to where the jobs are. Jobs don't stay in one place forever. To the extent that that isn't happening, the economy is going to stagnate. And gee, guess what? Our economy is stagnating right now.
Timothy Noah is a writer. His most recent book covers income inequality. It's called The Great Divergence. Twenty years ago this week, the Rwandan genocide began, when the political ideology of ethnic hatred gave license to thousands of Hutus to slaughter Tutsi families. But this ideology may not have unleashed a genocide if the international community had stepped in and stopped it from happening. NPR's Gregory Warner tells the story of how one episode of stepping aside forever changed the role of the U.S. peacekeeper.
Early in the morning of April 7th, 1994, thousands of Tutsis began arriving at a school on the outskirts of the capital, Kigali. They were seeking the protection of Belgian soldiers stationed there for the United Nations.
We believed in those brave soldiers.
On a memorial stage set up this weekend on a soccer field of that school, Venusta Caracira described how Hutu militiamen had surrounded the school, but they were blocked from entering because of their fear of the Belgians. Imagine our panic, he said, when one afternoon the Belgian soldiers packed up to leave. The Tutsis, including men and women and children, begged them to stay.
I remember one of us asking them to give us few guns so that we could protect ourselves, but still they refused.
Some asked the peacekeepers to shoot them to avoid a worse death at the hands of the militias. But the soldiers drove off, and the massacre that unfolded was so horrific it inspired a feature film called Beyond the Gates. After Caracira's survivor testimony, the next to address this crowd is a retired Belgian colonel, Jean-Louis Demblayden, who was not there at the school but at the airport where the soldiers were next sent. He says the young soldiers told him they saw the killers in their rearview mirrors.
Je les ai vus dans mon rétroviseur.
The soldiers had been ordered to leave, he says, to help escort European nationals to the airport so they could flee the country. Meanwhile, a larger contingent of Belgian soldiers, just a short flight over in Nairobi, were left idle.
La majorité des troupes belges sont restées.
We waited for them to be ordered to arrive, the colonel said, but those orders never came.
The soldiers knew that the killing would happen. The decision makers did not have it in their calculus.
David Simon, a political science professor with the Genocide Studies program at Yale University, says the United Nations of 20 years ago was much more respectful of state sovereignty. It didn't see civilian protection as its job, especially protecting civilians against their own government.
And so it was really just a non-thought about who might be protected, who, what lives would be lost.
But the abandonment at that school and in Rwanda as a whole affected the UN. It especially affected Kofi Annan, who was then in charge of peacekeeping. Professor Simon says you can draw a line between what happened in Rwanda and the rewriting of the UN mandate in 2005 to say that states bear a responsibility to protect their own citizens. Rwanda's foreign minister, Louise Mushikiwabo, whose brother was among the hundreds of thousands killed in the Rwandan genocide, told scholars in Kigali today that there is still a wide gulf between having those intervention tools on the books and having the will to use them.
It's a big mistake to believe that when you see the five permanent members of the UN Security Council and the 10 non-permanent members at any given time in New York, that they're sitting there to save the world. They are not. They are not.
To prevent future atrocities, she says, we need to allow big countries to preserve their political interests while not abandoning our fellow human beings. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Kigali.
Their official name is the Collective for Civil Parties of Rwanda. They're known as the Genocide Hunters, Daphrosa Gauthier and her husband, Alain. Their goal, find and help prosecute Rwandans living in France suspected of committing crimes against humanity 20 years ago. One of their most recent targets is former Rwandan intelligence official Pascal Simbekangwa. He's accused of aiding the massacre of hundreds of thousands of Tutsis during the Rwandan genocide. He is the first Rwandan to be put on trial in France and was recently sentenced to 25 years in prison. Madame Gauthier was at the trial. We recently spoke with her at her home in France. I asked her how she and her colleagues found Simbekangwa.
Mr. Simbekangwa was actually being searched for by the Rwandan authorities because he was very famous for his torture, for his ruthlessness, and he was recognized in Mayotte by some of the people who escaped his torture, so he was recognized there.
And so those people, they were Rwandans, they contacted you, they contacted the collective and said, we've seen him, is that what happened?
So the niece of a distant relative recognized him and called me, said that she had seen him, that he continued to harass us. And so it was through this family, this distant family connection, that I was contacted. Before we can contact the authorities, we have to gather proof. And so we had to go to Rwanda to seek out witnesses, because it's through the witnesses that we are able to build our cases. So in the end, it was a huge relief, a great weight off of our shoulders, and the end of a really long struggle of a very complicated situation here.
I want to ask, what made you decide to do this work?
I decided to start doing this work in order to remember, to reconstruct Rwandans as a whole.
You had left Rwanda and were living in France at the time of the genocide. How did you hear about it?
Yes, I was in France at the time that the genocide erupted. 1 month prior, I was in Kigali visiting my mother and my cousins, and I could sense that there was violence, there were tensions at the moment. My mother told me, hurry back home, you have your husband and your kids, and for us it's over.
And she was later killed, yeah?
Yes, my mother was assassinated on the 8th of April. From the beginning of the genocide to that morning, so a few days, we lost about 40 people in our family. They were shot and they were killed with machetes. You know, a situation like this is something that we live, but it's really hard to talk about.
How many people who are believed to be responsible for these crimes do you believe are living in France right now?
There are so many. You know, right now we're working, we have 25 cases, we're working on 5 more, but I could easily say that there are 100 people living in France.
We think about the case of Agatha Habyarimana, the former First Lady of Rwanda. She was charged with complicity in genocide by Rwandese authorities. The Rwandese asked France to extradite. They refused to extradite her from France, but then they also won't grant her asylum. It just seems like there's mixed messages from French authorities.
C'est un cas compliqué.
It's a really good question to ask. It would be really good, as far as you know, being a journalist, to ask this question of the French government. This is a legal case, a criminal case, but the French government hasn't proceeded with it. So it would be very interesting to get an answer to this question.
Why do you think the French government is reluctant to prosecute these cases?
I think it's because at the time, in 1994, the French government was absolutely complicit in these events. They trained the soldiers. They provided the killers with weapons. And so for this reason, the fact that they are completely implicated in what happened, they're very reluctant to proceed.
In 2010, the president of France at the time, Nicolas Sarkozy, visited Rwanda and admitted to grave errors of judgment by France during the genocide and said France would seek out those responsible. Do you think the French government is living up to that promise?
Upon his return, his government began the Office for the Investigations of Genocide. Since this group was created, things are moving much faster. They're moving really quickly. And there's a judge who is dedicated solely to the cases of the Rwandan genocide. And prior to this, there was no money, there were no resources to focus on this, and now there are.
Rosa Gauthier and her husband Alain have spent 14 years hunting down those suspected of participating in the Rwandan genocide who are living in France. Madame Gauthier, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a big thank you to Kate Schlosser from UCLA for translating. The dramatic and sordid tales of white-collar crime are familiar territory for writer Matt Taibbi. He wrote about them for years for Rolling Stone magazine. His pieces are an accessible way to a sometimes inaccessible subject. Quick and dirty explanations of the kind of behind-the-scenes dealings that led to the financial meltdown in 2008. Taibbi stopped by our studios in New York this week to talk about his new book called The Divide. It's about an American judicial system that sees corporations as too big to fail while seeing poor people as, quote, small enough to jail. Taibbi told me he was a political reporter before he got the assignment to explain what went wrong with the economy. So I asked him, what made him stick with white-collar crime?
I probably shouldn't admit this, but I thoroughly enjoy this topic in a kind of a dark way. There's a way to look at a lot of these sort of white-collar capers in an almost admiring fashion, look at the complexity of some of these schemes. And it's a real intellectual challenge to sort of unravel some of them. And for me, it was very thrilling to go from being somebody who couldn't balance his checkbook to having to understand, you know, how collateralized debt obligations worked and, you know, how the international interest rate swap market worked. And then there's a kind of deviousness and brilliance that is on display in a lot of these things that is really fascinating to me.
In addition to covering these stories on Wall Street, you then spent months on the other side of what you call the divide, in courtrooms and jailhouses that are full of poor people who you say committed lots of small crimes, but who are disproportionately prosecuted for them.
Yeah, and so I was covering these sort of gigantic Wall Street white-collar criminal scandals. And I became interested in the concept of why nobody was going to jail, why we didn't have criminal prosecutions. And then it occurred to me that it's impossible to really talk about the gravity of that problem unless you know who is going to jail and how those people go to jail and how that works. And what I ended up finding was that it's incredibly easy for people who don't have money to go to jail for just about anything. There's almost an inverse relationship between the ease with which you can put a poor person in jail for, say, welfare fraud and the difficulty that prosecutors face when they try to put someone from a too-big-to-fail bank in jail for a more serious kind of fraud.
Yeah, it makes sense that, you know, to look at one side of the divide of how poor people are disproportionately prosecuted really throws into relief how these other people, the rich people on the top, aren't.
Right.
But in some ways, is the comparison a little bit forced? I mean, at one point in the book, you're like, you know, just a few blocks away for where this guy's going to jail for having a joint in his pocket, this guy's walking free on Wall Street.
No, I mean, I can see that point of view. But, you know, the HSBC case was the biggest drug money laundering case in history. This is a bank that admitted to washing over $850 million for a pair of Central and South American drug cartels. They pay a fine. No individual has to do a day in jail. And all I really wanted to say was, here are actors at the very top of the illegal narcotics business who are getting a walk from the government. And right next door, you know, at that very moment, yes, I forced the comparison. I went to court that day. I asked around. I said, what's the dumbest drug case that you all saw today? And I found, you know, an attorney who was willing to sort of put me in touch with a number of people who've been busted and thrown in jail for having a joint in their pocket, which is incidentally technically legal in New York City, or at least it's decriminalized. And so that I did want to make that comparison. And it's not so much that it's so unfair that somebody who smokes a joint goes to jail. It's just that there's this weird sort of psychological thing that we're developing where we just sort of look at one kind of offender and we think that person is appropriate for jail. And another kind of offender, we just don't think that person is appropriate for jail increasingly. And I think that's what happened in this case. And I don't think it's a forced comparison because by itself, maybe letting off, you know, exercising some leniency with the individual actors at HSBC, you could make the argument that it makes sense. I don't agree with it, but you could make the argument. But it can't possibly make any sense if you're throwing people in jail for far less serious drug crimes. I mean, there's no justification for that in my mind.
Fair enough. Do you think we should, there should be more resources dedicated to covering these kinds of stories? I mean, is one of the problems that there are just not enough journalists on the cause to expose this stuff?
There are a number of problems with the way white-collar crime is covered in the press. Broad audiences tend not to be interested in the day-to-day goings-on of Wall Street. And so your typical financial reporter is somebody who's from this world, who maybe wants to work in an investment bank, and he writes in the language and the jargon of people who work on Wall Street. And those stories tend to be completely inaccessible to ordinary audiences. Over time, I think a kind of Stockholm syndrome develops. It's kind of the same thing that happens with campaign reporters and candidates. You start to sort of sympathize with the people you cover in this weird subterranean psychological way. And I think what ends up happening is these stories get written about, but they get written without outrage or without the right tone. They're sort of written for Wall Street audiences who want to find out how this lawsuit turned out. They may not want to see those people thrown in jail. They just might be interested in seeing, you know, how far the government is willing to go this week in putting white-collar offenders in jail.
Matt Taibbi, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kelly.
Matt Taibbi's new book is called The Divide. It's out this week. Whether it's Ricky Ricardo or the Buena Vista Social Club, Cuban music always seems to find big audiences here in the States. It's become the sound of the Caribbean for a lot of people. Well, a new compilation might expand our horizons a bit by introducing the sounds that came out of Haiti before and during the Duvalier regimes. The record is Haiti Direct, and this song was recorded in 1969 by a band called Tabu Kombu. Archivist Hugo Mendez produced the album.
The Haitian sound was something that was extremely important across the Caribbean at the time, but has been ignored for whatever reason, or has been difficult to get your hands on. And so now the idea behind the compilation was to represent music that has been very important for many people, but has not been available, say, in America or in Europe.
Hugo Mendez unearthed 28 lost recordings, and in the process, he got to know some of the musicians who played the music. Many had to flee Haiti to avoid the abuses of Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier. José Tavernier was one of these exiles. Before making his way to New York City and eventually Miami, he had a band in Haiti called Ibo Combo.
We were the first young Haitian who could play music in Haiti, because usually our family, well, musician was mostly womanizer and alcohol drinker, so they didn't want any part of that for their kids. So we got together, we played at the hotel Ibo Lele in Haiti.
I also read somewhere about some late night parties back in the Ibo Combo days when you were playing at the hotel where all the elites would hang out. You know, you'd play the regular set, but then sort of there was a late night scene. I'd love to hear about that a little bit.
Well, okay, after, let's say 3 a.m. in the morning when we stopped playing, somebody inviting everybody to his house. And sometime it was almost noon when I'm going back home. Crazy. That was Saturday. You know, they don't work Saturday and Sunday in Haiti. So sometime I spent 2-3 days out. Great and big party.
One of these times I want a time machine.
Yes.
And what kind of music were you playing?
That was, you know, what they call compa. Compa was a derivative of the merengue. Merengue is the dance of the slave. And the slave on Saturday, they could get together and dance. That's where came the merengue. And from the merengue, Nemours Jean-Baptiste in 1955 revised it a little bit slower, but with all the pep and everything.
With all the what? The pep?
The pep.
Yeah,
pep, you know, that, you know, keep you, drive you on.
Hugo, I wanted to ask you, how does this style of music change over the period that you cover here on this compilation? It's, you know, it starts in 1960, ends in 1978.
In the 50s and the beginning of the 60s, a lot of the music was based around a larger big band format, which was similar to bands in Cuba or even in America that were sort of jazz or Latin bands. And then the mini jazz movement, which Jose was instrumental in beginning in the early 60s, reduced the number of people in the bands and slightly changed the format so you'd bring more electric guitars or reduce the horn section. And then it re-expanded towards the end of the 70s with larger bands coming out with horn sections again with a different style, so the music.
I'm speaking with Hugo Mendez and Jose Tavernier about the new compilation of Haitian music from the 60s and 70s called Haiti Direct. Jose, how did musicians operate under longtime Haitian ruler Papa Doc Duvalier? He took over as president in 1957. We know it was a repressive regime. How did that influence the decisions you made as musicians at that time?
Well, that's a long story. I'm going to make it short for you. Okay, our country was called before the Pearl of the West Indies, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, everything went sour. People start leaving the country. And, well, like everybody else, myself in 1966, I had my bad encounter with what they had called Tonton Macout. And I had to leave the country.
And these were the militias that sort of ruled the land under Papa Doc, yeah?
That's right.
Hugo, I mean, did you find this with a lot of the musicians you researched for this compilation? It became a music of exile?
To a certain extent, yes. The records that were being sold of Haitian music, yes, they would mainly be sold in New York or Montreal because the expat community maybe had more disposable income than people in Haiti to begin with. It was a way of recalling life in Haiti, but it was a way of keeping the community together as well, and that the music stayed very solid wherever Haitian communities sprung up in the world.
And then for the musicians who stayed in Haiti, how did they continue to express themselves under Papa Doc's government and later his son's government?
I think that a lot of the subject matter of the songs is there's not so much political subject matter, certainly in the 60s and 70s, as the 80s, but much of the music was good time music.
So the music at that time was strictly entertainment. There were no sort of double messages going on?
Nothing as political or nationalism, nothing like that. They played entertainment.
And Jose, when you listen to this compilation, I'm sure you recognize, you know, familiar voices. Does it bring back memories for you?
Thank you for asking me that. But I wanted to say thank you first to Hugo for what he did. That is a great work. That's going to put our music in the world now. Thank you, Hugo. Secondly, to answer your question, yes, when I played those two CDs, almost tears coming to my eyes. That was emotional. It was like I was reviving my beautiful work, and thank you.
That's Jose Tavernier. He was a member of the Haitian band Ibo Combo. We also heard from Hugo Mendez, the archivist behind the compilation of Haitian music called Haiti Direct. Guys, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you,
Kelly.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yo me toreo. for the week ending April 6, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson, Patrick Murray is out, Marcia Caldwell and Leo Del Aguila are standing in as technical directors. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Phil Harrell is standing in for Steve Lichtai as senior producer. I'm Kelly McEvers, in for Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.